Hello and welcome to the latest edition of China Inc. by Bamboo Work, where we discuss the latest business and financial news from China and what it all means. I'm Doug Young, Bamboo Work's editor-in-chief, and I'm joined today by Renee Bangusky, one of our founding partners, who's also a longtime China watcher and former investment banker. Today, we'll take a look at a missed wealth management payment by Ping An Trust, and we'll also zoom in on automaker SAIC's sale of a majority stake in its India venture. We'll start with Ping An Trust, which is a unit of financial services giant Ping An Group. The company was in the news recently after it missed a payment of about $100 million for an investment product tied to a real estate asset from a developer called Junro Property. The company blamed Junro and said it's suing to get the money it's owed. So this certainly isn't the first case of a trust missing payments for wealth management products underpinned by real estate assets. What seems more significant here is the fact that it's Ping An, which is one of China's leading names in financial services. Up until now, most of the trusts to report such problems have been smaller names. So, Renee, is this a sort of canary in the coal mine saying China's trust problems are creeping up the food chain and infecting big names as well as, you know, the smaller ones?
Yes, and maybe no. This is not the first big name, though, that is caught in debt. You may remember then sometime last year, a trust firm called Zhongrong International Trust had issues paying, you know, disbursing payouts for wealth products. They were owned by a much bigger state, in fact, a company called Zhongji Enterprise Group, and that ended up being quite a sizable financial disaster. Mm. So that was not a small fish, and that was last year. But Ping An is at least to foreigners and inside China as well, a much better known name, very clearly. It is not the first time that Ping An has had problems with, you know, getting payments or disputes with issuers of trust products. But this one is the most recent and therefore the most visible. Mm-hmm. It has long been known that that entire trust industry was fraught with lots of potential problems. Those companies are not regulated, at least they were not regulated. The Chinese regulators have started an effort sometime last year, I think in the second half, to bring some oversight and some order to that entire sector. But, you know, they have thrived on the absence of regulation and pooling basically savings from, you know, people like you and me, Chinese households and so on, offering very high interest rates compared to anything else that Chinese people could hope to get from banks or even the bond market. Mm. This basically was predicated on the fact that the borrowers, companies borrowing from those trust companies, would pay very high interest rates because they basically had no or very little alternative means of borrowing money from banks or from the market and so on. So it was all kind of like this, you know, nebulous world where people who couldn't get credit, companies who couldn't get credit or enough credit to do what it is that they wanted to do, went to these firms that were not regulated and offered to pay, you know, much higher return. And in turn, the trust companies offered Chinese consumers, Chinese savers, extremely high rates of return. There were cases where people were told, you know, they would get 20% interest rates at times where you couldn't really get much more than 3 or 4% from holding money with banks or investing in bonds in China. Maybe we're getting 7%. It's, you know, you look at this and I would not really say Ponzi scheme, but it's a bit similar to what happened in the US with Madoff, who, you know, was offering unheard of extraordinary returns to people who were willing to believe that money grew on trees. And there are obviously structural differences and so on, but this is what has happened to that world. And now it's begun now. I think there was, you know, I think we're going to see more cases of that. This has been bubbling up for quite a while. And, you know, I mean, a lot of these trust companies were funding the real estate developers.
Right.
And that's in part what has accelerated, I think, you know, the problems for the trust industry in general. It's the defaults by real estate developers. And there's no end to that, at least not anytime soon.
Can you, I'm curious too. I mean, you're come directly from the financial services industry. This is sort of unrelated to this particular story, but why there's really nothing, at least that I'm aware of, like a trust industry in the US. I mean, why has China allowed this separate class of companies to emerge? And then, like you say, has placed very few restraints on them, much less requirements than, you know, a lot of other financial companies. Can you give us any insight to why this industry even exists? And like you say, it's gotten into lots of problems now.
Well, you know, it's kind of similar question to why did China allow the P2P industry to grow totally out of control, you know, 6, 7, 8 years back with very little supervision that resulted in a lot of fraud cases and so on. I mean, there were a lot of frauds in there, but there were also, you know, companies that were mismanaged, didn't know how to manage risk or whatever. And that went on for years and years and years. At some point in time, there were reportedly 4,000 to 5,000 P2P companies, and they were allowed to grow and boom and, you know, become extremely important overall until the regulators decided to crack down because lots of people were losing money. This I think, is you know, a similar case, a bit different dimension. Until it started to shrink about 2 years ago, this trust industry had assets of, I think, between $3 and $4 trillion. It's difficult to tell whether maybe, you know, if you go back in history a little bit, banks were typically and still today owned by the government, central government, provincial government, local governments, and all of that. And they were primarily funding state-owned companies. They didn't want to bother funding private enterprises because they didn't know how to assess credit risk in funding private companies, especially mid-sized, smaller ones, whereas lending money to SOEs was like a no-brainer. I used to say my granddaughter could have done that because they were owned by any type of government, so you were owned by the government as well, so you expected that your other government pocket would pay you back.
Right.
There was no risk basically doing that. So then you turn to the private sector, which if you go back, you know, 20 years at least, 15 years, started to grow fairly dynamically. These companies needed funding. Very, very often they couldn't get it from the bank, so they had to turn to alternative sources. And I think that when you sat at the top of all of that, you know, and you were looking at the economy growing and these companies were able to get funding one way or another and so on, everything was just dandy and things were working well and so on. And I don't think that nobody actually focused very deeply on how these pockets of parallel lending, if you want, were actually working.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I guess, so it's interesting what you say. I mean, P2P sort of it boomed, but then, you know, they realized there was a problem and they sort of stamped it all out, whereas these trusts have sort of been allowed to sort of linger on much more. But we'll have to wait and see. Next, we'll look at SAIC's sale of a majority stake in its India venture called MG Motor India. Now, for those who aren't familiar with SAIC, it's one of China's leading domestic automakers and has major joint ventures with General Motors and Volkswagen. The company announced it's selling 51% of MG Motor India to a consortium of local Indian investors for $624 million. SAIC is saying the sale will allow it to recoup most of its investment in the venture. So it's no secret that China-India relations aren't so good right now, and Chinese companies in India are coming under growing fire over accusations of things like tax evasion and spying. Do you think SAIC's sale has any geopolitical element, or do you think this is a purely commercial decision?
I would think so. They're not exiting.
Right. They've just sold.
Which is very clear. They're basically giving up control. And in an environment of difficult political relationships, when you have a feeling that, you know, Chinese companies, if you're a Chinese company, not particularly welcome any longer in India, then I guess you decide you want to take a lower profile. However, the country has enormous potential for growth across the board, but in the auto sector as well. And ideally, you don't want to, you know, completely leave. That I think would make sense. You become more of an Indian company. The largest shareholders in the consortium that bought the 51% is a relatively important, sizable, diversified industrial / business group in India. That should give, I think, a lot of support going forward to the venture. And if, assuming SAIC did it for this particular reason and they stay in, that should benefit them over time. The venture is obviously managed and controlled by the Indian side, so you would not expect that there will be any issues being raised by the government in terms of tax payments and so on, unlike what has affected other companies like Xiaomi in particular. Strategically speaking, you know, if you want to be there at a time when the growth prospects in India are actually better than in China, this move makes a lot of sense. There is a historical example, which is called Maruti. And Maruti was a company, first of all, that was a completely Indian company. And this goes back to the beginning of the 80s, actually. So we're talking 40 years ago. And the Maruti ended up under the auspice of the Indian government to enter into a partnership, a joint venture with Suzuki of Japan. Today, Suzuki owns, I think, 55%, something around that, of Maruti. Their ownership has grown over time. But Maruti today, I think, accounts for about 40-ish% of car sales in India. So here's an example of if you do it right, can go really right. So maybe that's what SAIC has in mind in terms of wanting to still be in there and hoping that it will benefit from that going forward.
Right. Although you pointed out, it sounds like Suzuki owns a majority of Maruti, whereas SAIC has basically given up control, you know. So if
But I think that, as you pointed out at the beginning, there's good geopolitical reason for that, right? But I think that I would assume that they actually recognized the inevitability of the current environment, but decided they didn't want to exit completely. This group that has taken, I think they took something 30%+. They didn't buy the 51%. They bought 30%+. Then local governments got involved also with some ownership and so on. That group has never been in the car manufacturing business, but they have a steel business. They have a paints business and so on and so on. So they're actually pretty bullish about the future, which therefore, you know, implies that they have to rely on the SAIC car manufacturing capabilities, which is under the MG brand, which was at some point in time a glorious British brand in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so therefore, I think SAIC is going to continue to play an important role, if only on the product side and the manufacturing side and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So it sounds like you think SAIC is in India for the long haul, at least for now, until things get worse.
Possibly. I think it would make sense. Who knows what will happen in the future in terms of, you know, the relationship between China
and India.
And India.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess if we knew that, we could all make some good investment. And yeah, let's wrap things up from there. Everybody, thanks for listening again this week. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and rate us and share us on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to join us again next week for another edition of China Inc., when we'll look once more at the latest trending Chinese business topics. Hope to see you all then. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye all. Thank you very much.